Tanya, line two is we're having the call now.
lecture mode on. Mute off.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for logging on so promptly. My name is Genevieve Williams. I'm the Director of Programs and Network Operations here at the U.S. Human Rights Network Coordinating Center. We have around 32 people that are registered for this, and around half of us are logged on. So we're going to give it another 2 minutes, and then we'll get started with announcements and with the training itself. So hang tight, and we'll be right back. Hello, everybody. Once again, my name is Genevieve Williams. I'm the Director of Programs and Network Operations here at the U.S. Human Rights Network. And we're just going to get started. As always, we start off with a quick welcome from the Coordinating Center to everybody that has registered. I know that we have both members and non-members on the call today. So thank you for the members for calling in. These trainings are for you. And for the non-members, I would encourage you to take a look at our website that has been fully redesigned and, look into the network and see if it's something that your organization or you yourself as an individual could take full advantage of its resources. So as always, we start off with some quick announcements.
1st, you should all have received the email around our magazine that's titled 1210. And just a reminder that the deadline is coming up for November 1st. And not only for articles, but also for announcements from your organizations. As we did last year, we are going to try compiling a list of December 10th events that are taking place. So if your organization is having anything, is doing anything special around December 10th, please email us. From last year as well, as you might recall, we had books that were coming out, member organizations that were doing calendars for sale. So all those precious pieces of information, if you could email it to myself at jwilliams@ushrnetwork, and we'll get them in the magazine and on the website as well. The second thing is that I mentioned before is our website has soft launched, so you can all take a quick look at it. We are still working through some minor kinks that include our email being down, and it seems that this is typical of any server that's being transferred over. So please be patient with us as we still work on the website and we finish the transfer over. In regards to our biannual conference, as you might know, we have postponed it until the spring. We're working through some final dates that we should have hopefully before the end of the week. But our Student and Youth Summit is going forward. The movement around human rights and student youth has told the network coordinating center basically that they need to move forward and have a strategizing meeting and summit from December 6th to the 9th. So that is still going forward. So if you know any youth that are still interested, please send them to our website and they can get all the information and get registered there. There are scholarships out that are available, or they can call our office at 404-588-9761 and ask for Sunyata. Once again, her name is Sunyata, and that's our youth organizer. The second thing, the last but not least, is that we are having another CERD shadow reporting training, and CERD is a convention on the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination, and that will be taking place on November 3rd in San Francisco, California. So if you or anybody else that you know might needs this training or might benefit from this training, please do not hesitate to contact me at 404-588-9761. And as always, we will get the bios and get started on today's training, which is the Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and Allies, Implications of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. First, we'll start with Daniel Hazen, is a human rights activist and advocate working with Mental Patients Liberation Alliance with special knowledge and of concern for the criminal justice system. The Mental Patients of Liberation Alliance, referred to as the Alliance, as a human rights activism and advocacy organization of, by, and for people with psychiatric labels. And Tina Minkowitz is the co-chair of the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, one of the leading international organizations representing people with disabilities. She represented the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry in the drafting and negotiation of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and she also participated in the UN Working Group that produced the first draft text of this convention. So without further ado, we would like to welcome Daniel Hazen and Tina Minkowitz. Daniel?
Tina, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Okay, you want to start?
Yeah, can I just ask how much time we have? Because we were going to divide it up in two, but I just want to make sure how much time there is, and then how much time there'll be for questions.
Okay, because we started on time, pretty much, we're now looking at 3:10, so we're looking at between 20 and 25 minutes, and then the rest will be for questions and answers.
Okay, so 20, 25 minutes total for the two of us to
Correct.
Share then.
Correct.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, I'm going to just start out, because I'm not sure who is on this call or how familiar you are with what we're calling the user-survivor movement, just a little introduction about that terminology. In the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, we define a person as a user or a survivor if they define themselves as such by virtue of having experienced madness or mental health problems or having used or survived the mental health system. So it's a very broad definition, and essentially it's people who have felt a significant impact in their lives of any of these issues. I also may use the term people with psychosocial disabilities. That's another way that we have started to refer to ourselves in the disability context, and people can ask questions about that if they're interested in more about the terminology. Okay, so the first thing to understand is that for the first time, users and survivors of psychiatry were a key influence in writing a UN treaty. As you heard from the bio, I was one of the NGO members of the working group that produced the draft text. We contributed textual language. We were making comments on every article in the convention to make sure that there was nothing that would even inadvertently reflect something that somehow excluded us. And in fact, there's nothing in the convention that we see as taking a position that would exclude any people with disabilities from any aspect of enjoyment of human rights or that would limit human rights for any of us. This is a real departure from what we're accustomed to in most laws, both national and those that have previously been done on the international level. There's always been some kind of exception to say, oh, well, if you have a mental illness, you have the right to not be institutionalized, only if, you know, basically you have the right to have them follow the right procedures to be institutionalized instead of the right to just live freely in the community like everyone else does. That's changed with this convention. It's a total departure because for the first time we're recognized as having exactly the same rights as other people, and this is going to have to ultimately be enforced. The key thing in the convention that shows what we call this paradigm shift in relation to people with disabilities in general, but particularly for users and survivors of psychiatry, is on the issue of legal capacity, which you'll find in Article 12 of the convention titled Equal Recognition Before the Law. The main thing is that it says states parties shall recognize that persons with disabilities enjoy legal capacity on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. Then it talks about an obligation to provide support for exercising legal capacity and safeguards on measures that relate to the exercise of legal capacity to avoid abuse or to prevent abuse. And one thing that's important in the safeguards is that it has to make sure that any such measures respect the rights, will, and preferences of the person. That means that anything that's coercive, such as guardianship or substituted decision-making that we're familiar with in the psychiatric system, where they say, you just don't have the capacity to make this decision, we're going to have the court or your family member make the decision for you, that's not lawful under Article 12 because it says that any such measures have to respect the rights, will, and preferences of the person. That's a huge revolution. In addition to the article on legal capacity, we have Article 14 on liberty and security of the person that says that people with disabilities have this right on an equal basis with others and that the existence of a disability shall in no case justify a deprivation of liberty. That's funny language. It was sort of compromised language, but essentially we read that as meaning you can't impose separate standards or procedures to deprive a person with disabilities of their liberty compared with the procedures and standards you use for other people. And that's exactly what the mental health system does. Most people can walk around knowing that if they shout a profanity at somebody in anger, as many of us might do from time to time, they're not necessarily going to be at risk of going to jail for it or losing their liberty. But if you have had a psychiatric diagnosis and your neighbors might hold that against you, you can end up being deprived of your liberty based on this kind of thing in the psychiatric system. That's going to be changed under this convention. In Article 17, we have a guarantee that every person with a disability has the right to respect for his or her physical and mental integrity on an equal basis with others. Things like forced drugging, forced electroshock, restraint, these things that we often refer to as psychiatric violence, are a violation of our physical and mental integrity. And it's further protected and in some ways more clearly or more obviously protected by a requirement in Article 25 on health that says that governments must require healthcare professionals to provide care of the same quality to persons with disabilities as to others, including on the basis of free and informed consent. So that means that governments must require that healthcare providers operate on a basis of free and informed consent for people with disabilities to the same extent that they have to do that for other people. Again, that's huge because we know in the mental health system that's obviously not respected. People in the mental health system are being locked up against their will, forced to ingest psychiatric drugs or to have electroshock against their will. So essentially, the upshot of these various provisions, plus there's also a provision, Article 19, on the right to live in the community on an equal basis with others. And that's also very important to get people out of long-term institutions, that we have the same rights to live in the community as other people do, whether we need support or not. We still have the same right. So the upshot of all of these things is that governments around the world will be legally obligated to eliminate all of these measures and practices in forced psychiatry, all the measures and practices of forced psychiatry. Forced psychiatry will end up being unlawful as a matter of international human rights law, as well as guardianship. Guardianship in the sense of something that's imposed on you that puts in another person to make your decisions and prevents you from legally being able to make your own decisions in some area of life. So all of these things are going to be made unlawful by the convention. Now, the U.S. has not yet signed the convention. There's some moves. There's been some pressure on them to do so, but I think it would be a difficult thing to accomplish, especially with this administration. I think the movement of users and survivors of psychiatry has a lot to contribute because we have a really strong interest in getting the U.S. to sign and ratify this convention so we can use it as a matter of law to change our own domestic laws and practices. We can still use the convention in many ways, even if the U.S. does not ratify it or does not sign it, because we can promote it as the operative standard in any of our advocacy, and some people are already beginning to do this. We can be referring to the convention in lawsuits. I believe that our Supreme Court in the United States has sometimes referred to international standards, even if they're not necessarily enforced for the U.S. So it's essentially something that creates a climate for change, and change is going to be happening all over the world, and it will come here. There's a strong user survivor movement here, even at the same time as we've faced lots of real setbacks in recent years, which I think Dan is going to talk a lot about. And what this convention gives us is both a legal tool and a kind of, well, some people have said, well, many of us are experiencing that it changes the terms of discourse, because everything that our movement has been saying for the past 20 or 30 years is now set down in a document approved by the United Nations that is becoming part of international law. We have a different basis to get people to hear us and to have an opening to get the changes made that we want. So it gives us a possibility. It's not going to be handed to us on a silver platter. There's a lot of work that we have to do, and many of us are already committed to doing that work, and I hope more of us will join. Now I'm going to hand it over to Dan. Thank you.
Thanks, Tina. I would like to talk a little bit about some of the difficulties in the U.S. I'm going to start off with the users and survivors, people who use service and have survived services or have used them, face many different laws. In 43 states in the U.S. Currently, there's what's called assisted outpatient treatment laws. And then we also, in all 50 states, we have forced psychiatric interventions. Some of those interventions would be electroconvulsive treatment, shock treatment, and forced medications, retention hearings to hold people in institutions. What I really want to focus on are the users and survivors and allies. An example would be when we have straight people supporting and backing gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer movement as an example. With the difficulties, users and survivors group, one thing I think is a lot of the groups that I've met is and worked with aren't necessarily using a human rights framework, and the convention allows us to utilize that in the language and to create allies such as lawyers, judges, people in the community, and other social justice movements across our nation to impact this and come together. One particular section that is a big interest to me is the criminal justice, prison reform, and prison abolishment groups, and how those groups, some of those human rights groups, may choose to use, and I want to say that politely, use the quote-unquote mental illness factor to move their agenda forward, maybe to reform the criminal justice system, the prison industry, and also the abolishment of such institutions. Unfortunately, that with such things like the death penalty movement, there's a call to utilize people with mental illness, and it kind of does marginalize people. It labels people, and it also counters Article 12 with the capacity. I really want to talk about how we could maybe understand the ally. And one thing I'd like to say is that there's many ways of helping people. One way is to impose what you think upon a client, And that's a typical approach from bureaucracies, especially human service systems. Another way is through charity, and charity is used to provide relief for suffering and express compassion for some. And the third way, which is helping people, is to become an ally. And some of those qualities of an ally that I think of, and I know others do in the movement, is say the charitable person keeps the victim dependent and creates or maintains the structure of dependency, while the ally will identify and help and to free the oppressed person from the dependency. The charitable person does not alter the victim's persistent need for help. The victim must depend on continued goodwill of that charitable person, whereas the ally helps the oppressed person become independent and self-reliant. The charitable person has his or her own view of a victim and how they feel, and the ally can understand the oppressed person's experience through the oppressed person's own words. The charitable person pities the victim, whereas the ally treats the oppressed person as a ally in change. The ally does not pity the oppressed person, but rather shares an anger about this victimizing circumstance and this oppression. And I'm kind of, these may not all follow in to some of the things, but I think they have something to reach when allies are looking. And it's often I find myself in the movement meeting people who want to pity me and talk about charity with persons who are labeled, which in turn perpetuates the system of lack of capacity and self-determination. So organizing around these and using these as tools and the ally as a tool and a quality to move forward and joining and using the convention and its articles to have lawyers start using the language of torture, of such interventions, judges be educated in regards to this. And when we talk about the prison industry, we're talking about an industry that's torturous in its own way, let alone working with people who are labeled. And so it's a reactive environment, and I'm looking at different ways with other people about what would be a reasonable accommodation for individuals to accept the responsibility of possibly a crime that one has committed, and to be able to serve what our peers would sentence us as. I'm not sure how much time. Am I still good, Tina?
If around 3-4 minutes, Daniel.
Okay. So my emphasis, I'm kind of focusing on criminal justice, but there's many groups, movements and organizations and communities that can learn about the convention and understand its articles and create networking opportunities and coalitions and take a look in their states as these 43 states that have these assisted outpatient treatment. This is just one law, and then also start to monitor the courts as far as persons being subjected to forced psychiatric interventions through shock treatment and also medications over objections. I'll leave. I do want to say when we talk about the level of capacity to control one's behavior is an influential factor only to be considered possibly at sentencing and not to be weighed during the fact-finding of a criminal trial. After a careful look to a restitution to the victims or a group affected by the crime, creative sentencing can mainly be addressed and address factors that would lead to the reduction in the risk of the crime being repeated. I think if we talk about a person being found guilty is fully responsible for the effects of the crime, using the lack of capacity as a reason for leniency dilutes the whole function of our legal system. So I'm kind of coming hard down on the criminal justice and the reformers and prison abolishers, but I see that group of people as great allies, because we're talking about institutions, and those institutions are oppressive systems. In the future, if anybody would care to discuss or create working groups in regards to networking and creating coalition and allies for take a look at your local state and your local government and see what laws are in effect that oppress people who use or survive psychiatric treatment. And I'll end there, and people will have questions, and thank you.
Okay, and we want to thank Daniel and Tina so far. Now, for questions, please press star on the keypad to ask a question. You will hear a voice prompt that says your hand is raised. And if you hear that your question has been asked already, please press the number, the pound key. So we can star one on your keypad if you have a question for Tina or for Daniel. Star one on your keypad, and we have a question from Sue. Sue?
Hi. Daniel, this is Sue Benoit-Davon from Amnesty International, and my main area of work is the death penalty. And you had said that you had some concerns, and I know that just speaking from others in the mental health community, I know that people have concerns because we are trying to introduce legislation along with certain state coalition partners to reduce the death penalty for people who have what we define as serious mental illness. It's basically what the resolution that the American Bar Association passed, which basically says that if you, under certain conditions, the mental illness is treated as an aggravating factor in a way that the death penalty is not a mitigating factor in a way that the death penalty is not imposed. And you expressed some concerns. I mean, can you just elaborate on do you think that is not a useful sort of, that is not useful for certain clients in the mental health community, or is it something that can be reconcilable? Well, understanding that our agendas are somewhat different ultimately.
That's a tough lot of questions. First of all, I want you to know that I oppose the death penalty for all people, and this is just my personal I've committed crimes, and I've also been the victim of crimes. And with the death penalty, it's a human right violation. Period. And I feel that the human rights organizations, and such as Amnesty International and others, utilize and marginalize. Now, I would not use the terminology seriously and persistent mentally ill. I wouldn't use mentally ill either. That's one thing that we need to address to ally is psychosocial disability. I feel like we're being marginalized and used to defeat the ultimate goal of ending the death penalty. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Appreciate your candor.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to the. Please know that I know that I've been in both systems, and both systems are oppressive and they violate human rights. But I feel like we're being marginalized. I do not accept the terminology mentally ill, nor do I accept the psychiatry's definition of it. And it wasn't too long ago that to be mentally ill was to be a person who was gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and gay. Queer. So Tina may have some legal answers to that. Not to throw you in there, Tina, but
yeah. I'm not familiar with the ABA resolution that you're talking about, but I'd be interested to look at it. I wouldn't want to comment on it specifically without seeing it, because, you know, the issue of legal capacity, one of the implications is that we oppose something like an affirmative defense of insanity. We would oppose anything that just says, because if you can prove that you had this kind of disability at the time you committed the crime, then everything else is irrelevant. But essentially what we're trying to do is to use disability-neutral standards, many of which already exist, such as the concept of mens rea, the concept of taking into account various factors as part of the circumstance of the crime, if there are good reasons to say that this is part of the circumstance in a way that it should, that a person doesn't deserve to be punished as severely, then there's a, you know, disability theoretically could be one of those type of circumstances. But we would reject anything that implies any that implies this concept of legal incapacity per se. So I'd be interested to look at that ABA resolution.
Okay. Yeah. It's. I mean, you can find it fairly easily on that website. Yeah. I mean, it's a challenge for us. And I hear what Daniel's saying, because I mean, that is something that we've heard from other groups. We've been working with the both the APAs and NAMI, and they've expressed, you know, they, while they want to work with us, they've also expressed those same concerns. So it's really somewhat challenging to kind of do this work effectively without sort of damaging some of the gains that have been made in the mental health advocacy community. So I appreciate.
I just want to say, to go back to some of what Dan was saying, right now there is no, there's not necessarily one single national organization that represents users and survivors of psychiatry directly. But it would be very unfortunate, it's always been very unfortunate if the APAs and NAMI are the ones that are effectively being heard. It's because often they've usurped our voice, and I hear that in this instance they may be saying something similar, but I know that they're not always. So it's important for allies to be seeking out our organizations and making sure that it's understood that we're speaking for ourselves. We're the people directly affected, and the family members, and the treatment providers often have opposing interests, especially given the structure of things like the mental health laws and the legal incapacity and substituted decision-making laws. They often have, you know, can have opposing interests to ours. So I just wanted to point that out, too.
Thank you, Tina, for that, and thank you, Sue, for your question. We are now going to take the next question, but if you could remember to press star 1 on your keypad. And we have a question from Slater Newman. Slater?
My questions have been answered.
Thank you, Slater. And we have a next question from RJ Thompson. RJ?
Hi, this is RJ Thompson from the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center in New York City. First, I wanted to thank Daniel and Tina both for doing this training. I think it's critically important. I think disability rights in general are very much misunderstood and not talked about enough within social justice and human rights movements. So thank you. I have a comment and then a two-part question. So, Daniel, you had mentioned that LGBT people had been labeled not too long ago as mentally ill, and I just wanted to make a slight adjustment to that and let folks know that that gay, lesbian, and bisexual people were demedicalized in 1973, but that transgender people are still considered mentally ill and still gender is medicalized, and people have to actually go through a lot of medical institutionalized, systematized processes to just realize their own gender identity. So my questions are, one, I know that there is quite a bit of cross-movement work happening between disability rights and LGBT groups, which is great. I wanted to ask you both, or either of you, if you see further potential for cross-movement building between trans-specific groups and disability rights groups, and particularly using the human rights framework, which seems really like a potential tool for me. And then also, how do we navigate folks getting the services that they need in terms of transitioning for trans folks, particularly versus our ultimate goal of demedicalizing and deinstitutionalizing gender?
I can respond to that. I can start. And thanks very much, RJ.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been aware that, or I suppose it's good that you pointed out and clarified that the transgender people are still being medicalized. I think in terms of the disability framework, one way that you could think of it is if you want to use the concept of imputed disability, or what's in the Americans with Disabilities Act, being regarded as having a disability, that makes you, that's in terms of the ADA, that also is included as being a person with a disability if you're being regarded as having a disability. In the user survivor movement, we like that because a lot of us don't really think of ourselves as having anything that's wrong with us, and we want to demedicalize the whole thing, just whatever experiences we have, that's who we are, period. And at the same time, there are others who do feel like, well, we do need services, or, you know, a person might feel like, I do have some limitations that I need support with. Also, deaf people often will say, I don't have a disability, you know, I just need sign language. That's the main issue a lot of deaf people will talk about. So, you know, there is that concept, if transgender people want to be able to use a disability rights framework without accepting the medicalization, they could talk about it as this kind of regarded as disability, or even something that they might want to accept that because of social attitudes could constitute a disability now, but hopefully at some point in the future wouldn't, because there is definitely a tension between those things. But I also think that you could also think about it in terms of something that's part of the user survivor movement, because we do really also define ourselves, anybody who's oppressed by psychiatry can be part of this movement, and without necessarily having to define transgender in some way as a disability. So that's another way I could see it.
Thank you. That's both really helpful.
I just wanted to thank RJ for correcting me and then stating that, because that's very valuable information for me to have, and I plan to use that. I'm working with a group in Albany just today and talking about this issue, and I never even looked at it that way, but one individual did talk to me about such things that you're bringing up. I'm at a conference, so I thank you for that.
Sure.
I think Tina said, and welcome to New York.
So, thanks, Daniel.
Back.
Thank you very much, RJ and Daniel. And we have another question from Drina. Drina?
Hi, Daniel or Tina. I was wondering if you could tell me what have been some of the success stories of the convention internationally.
Right now, the convention hasn't yet come into force. It was just adopted by the United Nations last December, December 13th of 2006, was open for signature on March 30th of this year. Right now, as of now, there's over 100 countries that have signed the convention, and I think over 50 that have signed the optional protocol, which provides for things like individual complaints to the Treaty Monitoring Committee. So far, 7 countries have ratified the convention. It needs 20 to come into force. So there are some countries, the ones that have ratified, I believe that for most of them, ratification, or all of them, ratification means that they're incorporating it in some way into their national law. And internationally, they'll be bound when it comes into force when there are 20 ratifications. So we don't have any successes yet in terms of actual implementation. We have what's a good thing is that in several of the countries that have ratified, we have strong people in the user survivor movement and or our allies that are in a position to try to work to make some of these changes that we want to see happen. And, you know, it's a huge amount of work to do. All of the disability movement is not well-funded, and, you know, it's a pretty grassroots movement. So there's a lot of work to do, but I hope, you know, 5 years from now we'll have some good things to report.
Thank you for that, Tina, and thanks, Trina, for the question. Remember, star one to ask a question for either Tina or Daniel. That's star one. And we have another question from Myra. Myra?
Hello, this is Myra. Myra Kaveri. I'm part of the Mind Freedom International and also a member of World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, and was present at some of the negotiations of the ad hoc committee meetings in New York. And I just wanted to amplify something that Tina said, I think, that about a success. My perception, there are two enormous successes that have come out of this that are not apparent in the like ratification process. And one Tina mentioned is an incredible alliance that has been built and is being built with the other disability rights activists. And the second thing is that leadership has really grown in the mental patients' rights movement all around the world as a result, or user survivors movement around the world as a result of our involvement in this convention, because people came from Uganda, from Peru, from Hungary, from really from all regions of the world. And we all had a chance to work with each other, to get to know each other, and to develop our own skills as leaders in the movement. So those are things that have already started, even though ratification hasn't happened yet. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Myra. And star one to ask any more questions from Tina or Daniel. And we have another question from Andrea Costello. Andrea? Andrea?
Hi, this is Andrea Costello. I'm a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Thanks very much for doing the training. I have a question in relation to Article 19 about independent living in the community. I have some experience doing Olmstead work on behalf of people with physical disabilities. And I was just wondering how you see the convention as, you know, in particular Article 19 related to sort of the limitations that have been placed on Olmstead since, you know, since 1999 when the Supreme Court decided it, and how do you think we can use, you know, this article and the convention to help push those rights forward and what do you see as those systems looking like, you know, in terms of, you know, I understand that there's, you know, some concern about service delivery and differences of opinion among everybody, and obviously people should have a right to choose what types of treatment, if any, that they want. But how do you see that relating to, you know, what an ideal community service delivery system would look like?
Okay, I'm actually not that familiar with what's been done with Olmsted since 1999. The past 5 years or so, I've been really intensely involved with this treaty and haven't kept up that much with U.S. law. But from the point of view of the user-survivor movement, I think the most significant way that Article 19 interacts with Olmsted is the Olmsted decision already has a limitation saying that unnecessary institutionalization violates human rights, and it allows the state's treating professionals to decide what is necessary or unnecessary. Now, I know that the Centers for Independent Living they've had some successes in being able to say they're going to come in and be the state's treating professionals. From what I know, it seems like it's not that easy to do that for people with psychosocial disabilities. So that's the biggest change from Article 19, that it's a right to live in the community, period. It's not, you know, the least intrusive alternative. It's that you have that right on the same basis as other people. In relation to community service delivery systems, there's going to be a lot that needs to be done. It may vary from country to country or even from locality to locality. The main thing is that it needs to be, you know, they need to be developed with the input of people with disabilities. For psychosocial disability issues, there's a really great new resource out there, a book called Alternatives Beyond Psychiatry. It's edited by Peter Lehman and Peter Stasny, and I'm sure you could find it on the Internet if you do a search. It's got essays from all over the world, mostly heavily from Europe, but, you know, more than that. And it's got, like, the accumulated experience of the user-survivor movement and our allies in creating the kinds of services that we want to see more of. So I think this is going to be a creative time. Information like this is going to need to be pulled together. A lot of information sharing should be taking place internationally. The convention requires international cooperation among governments, and there's a special mechanism to facilitate that happening at the UN level, which is that the Conference of States parties, instead of only doing, you know, kind of business and, you know, formalities and electing the members of the Treaty Monitoring Committee, which is what it does in most human rights treaties, the Conference of States parties will also be able to consider matters related to implementation. So that's going to be a way that there'll be an opportunity for NGOs and governments and everybody who's interested to come together and share information. I think it's going to be a creative time as people start looking at this is the obligation and bringing people together who actually have the experience, you know, relying heavily on what people with disabilities themselves are, you know, have developed. So I don't know. Dan might have something to add.
No, I think that's good.
Thanks, Tina. Tina, could you repeat the name and the author of that book again, please?
Sure. It's the name of the book is Alternatives Beyond Psychiatry. And the editors are Peter Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N-N, and Peter Stasny. STASTNY. And it's published by Peter Lehman Publishing. He's got a website. He's in Germany and I think has a U.S. distributor. So you can, I'm pretty sure you can order it on the web if people are interested.
Thank you very much. And we'll make sure to email the participants today all that information. Star one to ask one or two more questions. It is now 3:55, so we have another 5-6 minutes. So star one if you have any more questions for Tina or Daniel.
I actually have an additional comment I'd like to make if I can. I didn't really go into it in the discussion of the different articles, but Daniel had referred to the issue of torture. And during the negotiations, we were starting to put forward the argument that forced psychiatric interventions should be considered a form of torture or cruel and human degrading treatment or punishment. And that's actually an argument because really it was, you know, that's actually an argument that we still have the possibility of making. There is an article on the convention, in the convention that prohibits torture or cruel and human degrading treatment or punishment on people with disabilities, and it includes freedom from medical or scientific experimentation without the person's consent. So there's a whole lot that can be done on the issue of torture, and I actually have an article that I can send people information about also dealing with that.
Thank you very much for that, Tina. And one last question, star one, if you'd like to ask a question or if you have any closing comments. Okay. And we would like to thank all the participants today. We do have all your email addresses, so we will be keeping in close contact with you. And we will also email Daniel and Tina all your contact information so they can keep in direct contact with you as well. If you have any questions for us after this, our phone number in the office is 404-588-9761. As I mentioned before, the deadline for 1210 magazine is November 1st. So if you have any articles, announcements, events, any art, literature that you would like to share, book reviews, phone reviews, around human rights, of course, please make sure to email them to jwilliams@ushrnetwork.org. And we will try our best to include them in the magazine. And our next training conference call, as you all know, it's always the third Thursday of each month. So the next call will be November the 15th, and the topic or issue will be announced very shortly. So if you have any youths that would like to participate in our youth summit, please do not hesitate to refer them. They can give us a call or they can email us or visit our website. And please check out our website. And if you have any comments, concerns, or questions about the website and, well, the new website, please give us a call, 404-588-9761. And once again, if you have any closing comments, star one, and we'll be on until everybody hangs up. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean-Pierre. I just want, I'd like to, when we send out the URLs, I'd like to give the information for World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and also for the text of the convention. I can give the one for World Network now because it's short, which is it's www.wnusp.net. And the one for the convention is too long to give now, but I'll make sure to get you that information so you can send it to everyone.
Thank you very much, Tina. We'll be sending that before the end of the week. Okay, and thank you to all the participants today. And thanks, Daniel, and thanks, Tina, once again.
Okay. Bye-bye.